Design School has arrived at a historic milestone, 100 years of service to the local community. It was originally founded to provide music education to underserved students who might not otherwise have access. The school's mission has endured, even as it has frequently had to shift its approach in ever-changing times. I'm Mona Segetola Slami, and I hope you can stay tuned to hear music and stories as part of this radio special, Hochstein at 100. There have been many important moments that led to the school's centennial, and it all began with the legacy of one beloved Rochesterian. In early 1919, Rochester was in mourning. Young local musician David Hochstein was now counted among those lost in the war. He had been killed in the Battle of the Argonne Forest as part of the First World War in October 1918, though the news wasn't confirmed until months later. We can actually hear David Hochstein's violin playing in a couple crackly old recordings that he made with the Emerson Record Company in 1916. Here's David Hochstein playing Orientale by César Cui. Violinist David Hochstein with an uncredited piano player playing Orientale by César Cui, recorded in 1916 on a 7-inch 78 RPM disc. David Hochstein grew up on Joseph Avenue. His father Jacob was a highly educated Russian-Jewish immigrant who spoke six languages and ran a print shop out of their house. He was David's first violin teacher, but soon passed him on to more knowledgeable musicians from the European immigrant community in Rochester. David played in the orchestra at East High, which is where he met his friend John Werner, who played the piano. They got together to play music at Werner's house on Prince Street, where their music making was overheard by local arts patron Emily Sibley Watson. She was out on a walk when she heard this music through an open window, a bit of serendipity that changed Hochstein's life. Watson threw her full support behind David Hochstein, funding his musical education, including studies in Vienna, where he garnered prizes in several musical competitions and started to perform throughout Europe. He went abroad again to study in St. Petersburg, this time with the help of Watson's good friend and fellow philanthropist, George Eastman, who also obtained two instruments for David to play on, one by 18th-century violin maker Carlo Ferdinando Landolfi, the other a Stradivarius. Hochstein also wrote several compositions, which have just recently been recorded by faculty at the Hochstein School. Here are violinist Markus Kreutzer and pianist Gary Palmer with Minuet by David Hochstein. Minuet by David Hochstein, played by violinist Markus Kreutzer and pianist Gary Palmer, who are both on the faculty of the Hochstein School. David Hochstein's musical star was on the rise. He performed as a soloist with the New York Philharmonic and Metropolitan Opera and played a recital at Carnegie Hall. And then the war came. David was granted an exemption from serving because he was his mother's sole support at the time, since his father had passed away. But he changed his mind and applied to serve in the army anyway. One theory is that he was motivated to do something in contrast to his aunt, the famed anarchist and anti-war activist Emma Goldman, who had recently gone to jail for her protests. David continued with music while serving in the army. He played in a military band and started a 21-piece orchestra at Camp Upton, where he was stationed in Long Island. He then went to fight on the front in Argonne, where he was killed in action. The community rallied for a concert in his memory. On April 5, 1919, a crowd gathered at the Convention Center, the building that we know as Jiva Theater today, to hear a benefit concert played by Rochester's leading musicians. The proceeds from that concert were used to help start a music school. The David Hochstein Music School Settlement opened in the Hochstein family home on Joseph Avenue in January of 1920. By June of that first year, there were 330 students enrolled, with a waiting list of 110. Tuition was on a sliding scale, based on what families could afford. The school was founded as a settlement, part of a social reform movement started in England in the 1880s. Its philosophy was adopted in America in the form of settlement houses and schools that provided education, recreation, and other services to people in need, predominantly immigrants. The most famous example in the United States was Hull House in Chicago, run by Jane Addams. Music education played a major role in the settlement movement, and several music settlement schools continue to this day. For the founders of the Hochstein School, the settlement model made sense as a way to serve the community's needs while also paying tribute to David Hochstein's immigrant roots. The history of the school has been well documented by Gary Palmer, assistant director and dean of the Hochstein School, in his 2010 PhD dissertation, The Hochstein School of Music and Dance, History, Mission, and Vision, and in stories he shared in an interview earlier this year.
They found out early on that when they were providing services for the immigrant population, that one of the things that that population was most interested in was music. They responded by providing music opportunities. It was sort of two-pronged. They felt that music was a good sort of assimilation tool. You know, in those days, they thought that it was a way to socialize people and to sort of meld them into the community a little bit more. And then the immigrants themselves had come with traditions of music, and they thought that that was a way to sort of bring people together.
The Hochstein School's first director was Howard Gleason, George Eastman's private organist, who was also the first head of the organ department at the Eastman School of Music, which was founded in 1921, the year after the Hochstein School. Gleason's experience as the director of the Boston Music School settlement was of particular interest to Eastman when they first met. Their second director was Samuel Beloff, an Eastman School of Music professor who was the violist of the Kilbourne Quartet. He started the school's first orchestra and the Hochstein String Quartet, which performed at George Eastman's home, the Valley Club, and other places around Rochester.
There's always this polarization between allowing access and quality in terms of education. We really believe that you can have quality and excellence and still have access. They're not mutually exclusive. But I think at different times in the school, things went different ways. I mean, when Samuel Beloff became the second director of the school in the end of the 1920s, I mean, he pretty much said he wanted to be a smaller program and wanted to make it more professionalized. Whereas later in the 60s, when funding was sought from the community chest, which is now the United Way, I mean, there was things really turned the other way, where if you read the description of the mission in the mid-60s, at one point it made it sound like we were a social services agency with music being the mechanism.
The Hochstein School grew in the following years, adding students and subjects, and moved to a new location on Holzer Street in 1928, where the school remained for the next 50 years. On the way, more stories from how the school continued to adapt and a star conductor's time in our community. Here is more music from Hochstein's legacy. This is the Hochstein Alumni Cello Ensemble, recorded at a concert in January 2020 with the Nocturne from A Midsummer Night's Dream by Felix Mendelssohn, as arranged by Glenna Curran.
Thank you.
The Hochstein Alumni Cello Choir, playing the Nocturne from A Midsummer Night's Dream by Felix Mendelssohn, as arranged by Glenna Curran. You're listening to Hochstein at 100, a century of music and stories from the Hochstein School. By the late 1950s, as the initial reasons for the school's founding faded into history and finances became an ongoing issue, the Hochstein School faced a crisis. Did it still have a reason to exist?
They had felt that they were no longer serving the initial immigrant population that they had served, because a lot of those families from that had come initially from Europe that lived in Joseph Avenue and that lived in the city had all moved out to the suburbs. So they felt as if they were serving people that could afford to pay for lessons, and at the same time they were not serving those who most needed to be served.
Board President Hilda Taylor wrote to Howard Hansen at the Eastman School of Music for guidance in 1959. "We would further appreciate an expression of your personal opinion as to whether a discontinuance of Hochstein would deprive the community of any substantial service which is not already provided or reasonably available." Hansen replied with advice and encouragement to press on, writing, "The importance of the contribution of the Hochstein School to music in Rochester over the years has been so great that it would seem a shame to see that contribution discontinued. Perhaps we can find a philosophy which will adapt the organization of the school to the new condition which it now faces." With Hansen and the Eastman School of Music's support, the Hochstein School reevaluated their programs and ended up refocusing and expanding their reach in the community. Conductor Paul Freeman was hired as the school's first full-time director in 1960. The Hochstein Sinfonia, a combined student-faculty orchestra conducted by Freeman, had its inaugural concert in 1960 to a standing-room-only audience of 600 people. The Sinfonia played for the Hochstein School's music appreciation classes, went on tour to Washington, D.C., and played concerts that allowed Hochstein faculty members to shine as soloists. Here are three musicians who are all currently on the faculty at the Hochstein School: cellist Kathy Kemp, clarinetist Peggy Quackenbush, and pianist Darlene Hood, playing Ballade, composed by David Hochstein.
Thank you.
A trio of musicians who all teach at the Hochstein School, cellist Kathy Kemp, clarinetist Peggy Quackenbush, and pianist Darlene Hood, playing Ballade, composed by the school's namesake, David Hochstein. You're listening to Hochstein at 100 on WXXI. Paul Freeman's time as director of Hochstein ended when he left Rochester in 1966 to lead a school in San Francisco and to further pursue his international conducting career. He is particularly remembered for founding the Chicago Sinfonietta, performing and recording music by Black composers, and his tenure as the chief conductor of the Czech National Symphony in Prague. As the Hochstein School expanded in the 1960s and the following decades, new subjects were incorporated into the curriculum, including jazz, early childhood music, and dance. The school's next director, Alice Conway, was a harp teacher who had also directed the children's chorus and worked in the school's administration. She led Hochstein in partnerships and programs that focused on the social services aspect of the school's work, including outdoor community concerts and the Summer Arts Camp of 1968. The Hochstein School led this program in collaboration with the City of Rochester, bringing together 2,400 students from throughout the region, representing 16 social service agencies, including 5 settlement houses. Music, visual arts, and drama were all part of this ambitious project. In a time of increased awareness of the racial and social divisions in Rochester following the riots in 1964, the summer program was praised for bringing youth together, including in an article by Democrat and Chronicle columnist Cliff Carpenter titled "Integration at Its Best." These citywide summer programs continued through the early 1970s through the leadership of 2 more directors. Paul Burgett, who was a beloved figure in Rochester's musical community for decades, is often associated with his many years as dean and senior administrator at the University of Rochester, but he was also the director of the Hochstein School for just about a year while he was a graduate student at the Eastman School of Music. In choosing his successor, the Hochstein School Board debated what they should look for in a candidate: artistic accomplishment or business sense, a music educator, administrator, or both. For the first time, they also actively considered race and gender. 2 of the full-time directors had been Black, Paul Freeman and Paul Burgett, and 1 had been female, Alice Conway. When they decided to hire Helen Tuntland to lead the school next, it is reported in meeting minutes that 2 ladies of the committee objected to her for the job on the basis of sex. Before taking on the role of director, Helen Tuntland was an organist and a music educator who had received her master's degree at the Eastman School of Music. In interviews, she described her view of the Hochstein School as being that of an overall center for the arts. She oversaw new social programs and partnerships, while also leading the school to greater professionalization and national recognition for its role in community music education. As the school continued to grow, they were running out of room in their space on Holzer Street, even to the point of sometimes using bathrooms for lessons. Break-ins and vandalism were an issue. A firebomb was thrown into a window, damaging a classroom. And then, in 1974, tragedy further underscored the need for a change. Perry Protz, the husband of the Hochstein bursar, was murdered in the school's parking lot, defending his wife from an attempted robbery. In 1975, the Hochstein School moved to its current central location on North Plymouth Street in the former Central Presbyterian Church building, first as a tenant and then purchasing the building for the sum of $1. This storied location adds to the sense of Hochstein's connection to Rochester's history, as Gary Palmer relates.
We sort of feel as if it were sort of on hallowed ground, and, you know, the Underground Railroad history and the history of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony sort of dovetails nicely with our mission and everything that we do.
Lunchtime concerts, first called Noontime at Hochstein, began in 1975 with flutist Glenda Dove and pianist Joseph Werner. 2 years later, WXXI began broadcasts of these concerts, which have continued to this day as Live from Hochstein, a program which I enjoy hosting for WXXI, following the footsteps of Simon Ponton, Mordecai Lipschutz, Chris Van Hoff, and Brenda Tremblay. Hochstein's music therapy program officially began in 1975 after several years in development and grew in collaboration with Nazareth College. It still flourishes, with expressive arts programs in music, art, and dance therapy that serve clients both at the school and in agencies throughout the region. As we continue to travel through the Hochstein School's history, here's more music. This is the Hochstein Alumni Orchestra, conducted by its founder, Hochstein alumnus Evan Meccarello, with cellist Annie Jacobs-Perkins, in the first movement of Franz Joseph Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 1.
Thank you.
Hochstein Alumni Orchestra, featuring cello soloist Annie Jacobs-Perkins and conducted by Evan Meccarello, in the first movement of Franz Joseph Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 1, recorded in the Hochstein Performance Hall in a concert that kicked off the school's centennial celebration at the beginning of 2020. You're listening to Hochstein at 100. The school's ensembles and opportunities for student performances were further developed in the 1980s under the leadership of multifaceted musician Carl Atkins, a conductor and composer whose musical expertise ranges from jazz to opera. 100 years after its founding, the Hochstein School continues to serve the community through music education and the tuition assistance program that ensures all can participate, regardless of ability to pay. And the school is developing new ways to connect people with music, including as a participant in outreach programs at neighborhood community centers. The current executive director, Dr. Peggy Quackenbush, has been with the school since 1979 as a teacher, administrator, and then as director starting in 1991.
It seems as if there's a story nearly every day. There's a moment that I particularly remember when I was just struck by the desire that sometimes appears. We were doing some kind of registration day, and I saw this mother and little child, a three-year-old, come in, and the grandmother of this child come in. She apparently had been asking to play the violin forever, and she was three. And her grandmother said to me, she finally turned three, so she's old enough now to take Suzuki violin lessons, but she's been begging for it for a long time. But the thing that struck me the most was she walked in. We had a display case, and there was a small violin in the case. She walked up to it and asked me if I would take it out for her because she was ready. She was ready to play it, and she wanted it right now.
These days, students play in rock bands at Hochstein, learn about the connection between comics and music, play ukulele or banjo, and take classes in music technology, in addition to traditional classical music and jazz studies. There are several choruses, bands, and orchestras, and a variety of chamber ensembles. And Hochstein's Performance Hall is used by many musical groups as a concert venue, including the RPO, community choruses and orchestras, chamber music, jazz, and pop groups. Cellist Stefan Royce recalls what it was like seeing the space develop.
I came here in 1988, and for many years in the beginning, the Hochstein Performance Hall looked like it was after the war somewhere in Europe. It was beautiful and it sounded wonderful, but it was in terrible shape. I remember there was a big net hanging from the ceiling because they were worried that some of the ceiling would fall down and hurt people, and there was no stage yet. It used to be a church, of course. There was no stage at all. So we would play at the lowest point in the hall, which was in the front. And then, of course, the stage was built, and then the hall was renovated beautifully. It's my favorite hall in Rochester, I have to say.
Quackenbush described the work of developing the building, the teaching studios and the classrooms, as well as the hall, as a dream come true.
The development of that facility really allowed us to truly have an orchestra program, to truly have a dance program where we could present our own performances on our own stage, and to allow us to then really bring more and more people together and to bring the community in, not only for our events, but for lots of other organizations' events. So we broadened our community in this way, and we brought it together toward us in this way. And it's been truly exciting in all the 21 years since then to see it continue to unfold in so many different ways.
The Hochstein School now faces the struggle of maintaining that community without being able to gather in its building. As the school's physical doors are closed and some programs are suspended in response to COVID-19, the instructors have adapted to teaching through online platforms, including individual music lessons and group dance classes. Here is some music recorded in the Hochstein Performance Hall at the beginning of the centennial year. This is the Hochstein Alumni Orchestra, conducted by its founder Evan Meccarello, in the Zampa Overture by Ferdinand Erold.
Thank you.
The Hochstein Alumni Orchestra, conducted by Evan Macarello, playing the overture to Zampa by Ferdinand Erold. That recording from an earlier concert was recently watched by hundreds of people online as part of a virtual celebration of the Hochstein School held on April 5th, 2020, the same date as the David Hochstein Memorial Concert that helped to found the school a century ago. Hochstein's legacy continues, teaching, connecting, serving our community through more changes and challenges, as Peggy Quackenbush presciently described in an interview earlier this year about the continued importance of the Hochstein School's work.
It's such a big need, I think, for so many people right now, whether you're young or not so young. The need to find a mode of expression, the need to get input from other people in a different kind of way, in a way that music or dance can give us, the need to engage with other people in the process. That's not really an end point. There's never an end point. I'm still learning how to play the clarinet. I'm still learning what music is really all about. I think this is the engagement that our society, that everybody in our society really longs for. We are at risk of becoming too isolated. And this kind of activity is powerful in how it helps us to relate to each other and to the rest of the world.
Special thanks to Carl Pultz of Alembic Productions, Timothy Fabrizio, Alan H. Miller, and Wallace Russ, staff and faculty of the Hochstein School, Peggy Quackenbush, Debbie Treader, Janice Hansen, Kathy Kemp, Marcos Kreutzer, Darlene Hood, and especially to Gary Palmer for his research into the school's history, and to Evan Macarello and the Hochstein Alumni Orchestra. Thanks to colleagues at WXXI for making this possible, Gene Fisher, Ruth Finney, Mark Ruby, and Andrew Croucher, and Daniel J. Kushner at City Newspaper. You can find this full program online, along with historical photographs, at classical915.org. I'm Mona Segatola-Salmi. This has been Hochstein at 100, a production of WXXI Public Media.